Thank you for joining us for this episode of Ship History Radio from the Steamship Historical Society of America. Through recording, preserving, and educating, our mission is to share the impact of engine-powered vessels, their crews, and their passengers with future generations. To learn more about our organization, visit sshsa.org. My name is Amy Bachari, and I am the Education Director. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Kelly Nakamura about Japanese immigration to the United States and picture brides, a practice of arranged marriages where partners were selected by photo and personal recommendations from friends and family. In part one of this interview, we discussed Japanese laborers coming to Hawaii to work in the sugar plantations in the late 19th and early 20th century. Hawaii's plantations were booming, replacing the southern plantations that were destroyed after the American Civil War. Travel by steamship, Asian immigration, labor conditions, and the relationships of arranged marriages were discussed. If you haven't heard that episode, I would highly recommend going back and listening to understand the context of part two, where we will dig deeper into this topic. Steamships like the Chiyo Maru, the Nippon Maru, the Korea, and the Persia called at the port of San Francisco carrying passengers and goods such as silks and teas. Newspapers like the San Francisco Call, which reported on daily departures and arrivals of ships, provided news and weather tips and listed the passengers and goods arriving from multiple countries. Often, articles listed the number of, quote, Asiatics, and specifically the number of picture brides that were on board in steerage. A voyage across the Pacific took several weeks, and with many ships making this trans-Pacific crossing, picture brides arrived every few weeks. In 1911 and 1912, reports about the brides appeared in the Call on average, monthly, with 3 to 46 brides arriving on each ship. Dr. Nakamura is an associate professor at the University of Hawaii System, a scholar and a journal editor at the Hawaiian Journal of History. She's a published author, researcher, and educator committed to embracing curricular innovation and best practices, particularly in online learning for underrepresented populations throughout the Asia-Pacific region. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me to be here, Amy.
I wonder if you've come across a specific story in your research that would highlight for our listeners what it would have been like for a couple participating in this type of arranged marriage.
You know, I always encourage audiences, if you want to see, you know, kind of a little bit more of the reality of what it is to actually, you know, see visually of what this picture bride process was, I encourage people to watch, you know, an older film. It's called Picture Bride. It tries to reenact what it actually is for these women to come over and the motivations. So, you know, you did hear, you know, stories. And by the way, these women also, when I say women, they also range in age. I've, you know, read accounts that these women were as young as 14 years of age. So honestly, children who would be married off from their families because their families were struggling to men that they actually don't know anything about. Some of them, in fact, found a suitable partner. So I don't want people to come away thinking that all these marriages fail and are just horrified and terrible. But I don't think that many of these women expected the level or the degree of labor and work that was expected of them. So I want to kind of highlight then, if I cannot focus on one particular story or one particular, you know, vignette, this idea of the double day that I think many, not just women, but also men face right now. So these women came over without any support, any kin network, any female community that would be able to help them. So they often said that they worked not just up to sun up, sun down, but pretty much 24 hours a day, with the exception of trying to sleep and recover from their labor throughout the day. So you had multiple jobs that you had to do, which again is something very familiar to parents, and in particular single parents. You had to raise the children. But first you got up, usually around 3 or 4 a.m. because you were paid at a disparity from the men. So some of your additional jobs is that you would cook for the bachelors in your community. So here you would be at 3, 4 a.m., trying to make bento or box lunches for the other bachelors that you would then sell for extra income. Then the children would awake, then you would have to feed them. And of course, you would have to wake your husband and feed him also. Both of you would then go off to work, labor for at least 8 to 10 hours a day, and then come back. You as a woman would then expect it to do your responsibility of the household chores, of maintaining the household, cleaning, cooking, caring for the children, feeding your husband, and maybe because you did need additional income, you'd also at night do laundry services for the bachelors in the community. So, you know, despite the fact that these women came from peasant or working class backgrounds, many of them reported that they never expected how tired they would be all the time. And they never got any rest until they actually formally retired and their kids actually grew up. It was nonstop work from sunup to sundown. And if you're a single parent, you can kind of empathize with the fact that, you know, you don't have that kind of partner support, or that you are expected by gender expectations to cook, clean, care for the kids, make money, and do all these additional jobs to make ends meet. So I think any modern audience right now can kind of empathize with the experience that they're going through, that these women, you know, sometimes they said they felt like single parents because they were the ones that took their kids into the fields. They were the ones who had to cook and clean and were assigned additional domestic chores for the bachelors of the community if they wanted to gain extra income, because women are still paid, even in the present, at a different rate than men. So we do have to work harder. We do have to do sometimes additional jobs, especially if you're a single parent. So, you know, I was just talking to a colleague and I said, you know, that's why the majority of elderly in poverty are women. Women tend to live longer than men. There is a pay disparity between men, even still today in the 21st century. Women often take off time to do caretaking activities, which is kind of socially expected of them. So, you know, women are often in a more precarious financial situation than men. And unfortunately, that has not changed. It's gotten better. But, you know, I mean, if you ask, you know, people, what are you doing? I said, you know, for example, you know, I'm doing this interview at 6:30. I said, you know, this is late for, I'm up at 4, you know, I mean, usually, right? I mean, not a problem, Amy. And we met actually at 4 a.m. And you're like, why are you meeting at 4 or 5 a.m.? I said, nope, been up for an hour. Have to get the household going. Got to get everything clean. I'm up. And most single parents can actually empathize with that. Yep, your day begins early.
Yeah, it's true. And I think even maybe we have less physical work in the sense that we don't have to hand wash the dishes or do the laundry by hand.
Oh, thank goodness.
But you still have to do those things. So I think, yeah, I think people will be able to empathize with that. But it seems like it was just harder on the women than it was on the men, because the men wouldn't have been expected to help take care of the kids. Even working in the fields, you're trying to work in the fields and you have to look after your children at the same time, where the men can just focus on working and coming home and resting and going back to work. Whereas the women at that time.
And even still today, I mean,
yeah,
I you know, I am very fortunate that, you know, I teach and I can literally, and I do, I bring my child to work with me when she's off on her summer or winter vacations or holidays. And this is where you do see, you know, children being following their parents, following their moms to work as they go. And I still think that's more common. So even for my students, I see primarily, you know, and I encourage them. I said, if your child is off, because I teach college level, said, if your child is off that day, it is a child-friendly class. Bring them. They're always welcome. I'll let you know if we talk about anything inappropriate. But I do empathize with parents who, you know, are faced with that struggle of, and you see, you know, moms, you know, being trailed by their kids and you got to drag them along and things take so much longer than they absolutely have to. And, you know, this is where I think doing something like a Zoom interview is so much easier, because we have that convenience of working around our schedule, whatever that may be. And, you know, again, these women, I don't want to romanticize what they did, but I mean, we're talking about true sacrifice and true commitment to what they were actually doing. Many of them, in fact, did not have a choice. We've also talked about how some of them, in fact, became victims of domestic violence. And, you know, in my class, you know, we discussed this phenomenon. So domestic violence still today is a phenomenon that is still underreported, particularly in immigrant communities. for a number of reasons. Sometimes it's cultural, the shame of this. Sometimes it's also kind of the logistics of who or where do I go to report this, especially if I'm not a citizen, especially if I'm an immigrant at this particular time. And so, you know, we do hear stories of women divorcing because these men were incredibly violent, you know. And it's not because necessarily they're inherently evil or bad people, but think about the fact that, you know, these men were oppressed. These men were sometimes beaten at work by the lunas or overseers. These men struggled, and sometimes they took their frustrations out on their families, on their wives. So, you know, we do have divorce accounts where, you know, these women, to their credit, are testifying and saying, you know, my husband came home drunk yet again, and he was chasing me around with a knife, trying to kill me. He was beating me with the iron. So think about, you know, the old heavy cast irons, and he was just beating me with it. He was kicking me until I was, you know, on the ground. I had to flee to the neighbor's house. You know, these are all true life accounts that you read about in these divorce records. And these are the ones who officially got divorced. That's incredible. So divorce, you know, even so today, sometimes, you know, there's this shame or stigma. But to testify why you got divorced in those kind of very personal reasons, I think that's also something that we have to give these people credit for, to have the strength to share what had in fact happened to them. So unfortunately, domestic abuse is also not a contemporary phenomenon, but something that's been going on for generations.
You know, you think when reading those accounts, I'm sure, and you can just empathize with how hard that must have been at that time in that type of community where you may not have citizenship or you might not be fully secure with where you are. And then the amount, I mean, that's probably a tiny percent of people who actually reported it and went through with the divorce. Surely the numbers were more, it was occurring more often than would have been reported.
Exactly. So when, you know, 30 to 40% of the population is officially getting divorced, right? I mean, think about it. I mean, we don't think, you know, in America, people sometimes have, oh my gosh, you know, we're in moral decline because 50% of us are getting divorced. I said, you know, when we have statistics, if you look at the divorce records of nearly 30, 40% of the first generation, you know, your grandparents or at this time, your great grandparents divorcing, that may shock people. But, you know, think about the reasons for that. I mean, we didn't have an awareness of mental health issues, or we didn't have an awareness or an encouragement to seek out assistance if you are a victim of domestic abuse. I mean, things that still today we are still trying to encourage survivors to seek help is something that was not encouraged back in the day, which is, you know, just terrifying and horrifying and on so many levels. And even till today, I mean, we do talk about the fact that immigrants in particular, it is likely that the numbers of domestic abuse incidents are underreported because of language barriers, because of citizenship issues, financial issues, cultural pressures to not bring shame upon the family. You know, these were all deterrents. So you also hear some women, in a sense, not necessarily rejoicing or being happy, but just being relieved when their spouse passed away because one less mouth to feed or one less person I have to take care of. And that's the reality of my life. You also saw, though, some women, when their spouses die, being in a real pickle, in a real fix, because that was the primary breadwinner. And now I have four kids. What am I going to do? How am I going to survive? And this is where, you know, you see both ends of the spectrum of women become further impoverished by the death of their spouse, because again, generally speaking, their spouses would pass away earlier because, sorry, gentlemen, women tend to live longer than men. And at this time, it was more traditional that there was an age disparity, sometimes of decades, between husband and wife. So again, it doesn't surprise me why many, if you go to any nursing home, what is the gender of both of the residents? But it is the majority of women. And unfortunately, again, women still are paid less than men. Women still often have the brunt of caretaking activities. So they take a financial hit because sometimes many of them do take off. Or when I say caretaking, not just children, but parents and other family members, to be perfectly honest. And also, of course, women have all these additional pressures. So women have to be aware of what is their options that are available to them. And I think society in general also has to be aware that caretaking also is a job, one of the hardest jobs that you'll ever do.
I was curious what it would have been like for Japanese immigrants at the time. We've talked a lot about what it would have been like in their own communities and within their own families and their work environment. What would it have been like with the broader either Hawaiian community or when Hawaii eventually became part of the U.S.? I mean, it wasn't a state until the 1950s, right? But it was overthrown in 1898, right? So then a lot of those Chinese exclusion laws applied. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about racism or discrimination against the immigrants at that time.
You know, when we do have, you know, various legislation such as the 1924 Immigration Act that pretty much stopped immigration for a number of years, and these immigrants were in fact kind of a captive audience here, not just in Hawaii, but also on the mainland. We really see kind of a limiting of their options and availability. So when you are literally stuck in a country and you don't have any recourse, because once you return back, you could never come back, you know, you do see greater kind of pressures on these immigrant communities. So, you know, let me address your first question. You know, what was the experience with the broader or larger Hawaiian community? So on the plantations, the plantation owners, in fact, encourage ethnic differences to spur on racial competition between different groups, because different groups were paid on different pay scales. So the very top were the white managers and the white owners of the plantations. And then you have the second class, which are the overseers, who are the Portuguese. These are the people who kind of monitored the workers and also communicated with management. Then you have the Chinese, Japanese, Koreans, and at the very bottom, you see the Filipinos. So not only did we encourage ethnic difference by paying different ethnic groups, different pay scales, but what we also see is that you also have ethnic camps developing on the plantations. So when you talk to old plantation, you know, residents or old plantation families, they said, oh yeah, that was a Japanese camp. That was a Filipino camp. That was a Chinese area. They were racially segregated with each other. And that was deliberate by the plantations. They, in fact, encouraged racial differences to spur on economic competition. So, for example, you Japanese, you need to work hard because the Chinese are being more productive than you. So they encouraged that kind of racial pride and competition for their own benefit. So for the most part, plantations were kind of autonomous entities within the larger kind of Hawaiian community. Many people did not leave the plantations regularly. They kind of were born, raised, lived, existed on the plantations. Transportation between plantations was in fact limited. It was deliberate. Really, the only kind of transition from that would be World War II. So in talking about the experiences, you know, let's focus on, for example, the Koreans. The Koreans were kind of this unique position because they were mischaracterized as Japanese because Japan had conquered Korea by that particular time in history. So by the 20th century, Korea was part of the Japanese Empire. So when Korean immigrants had arrived, they faced multiple discriminations, especially the women. So they faced discrimination because they were non-white. They faced discrimination because they were non-Japanese. And they faced discrimination because they were women. So it was kind of a trifecta of gender, race, and an additional racial class added on to that. So, you know, within these ethnic groups, there was not just simply hostility between whites and minorities, but there was also hostilities between minority groups who remained predominantly isolated on the plantations until World War II actually occurred. In talking about the experiences of women and their relationship to other communities, for the most part, you know, the majority of women on the plantations were in fact Japanese. The Filipinos remained a primarily bachelor community. So this is where you will see houses of prostitution emerging on the plantations. And prior to World War II, The majority of prostitutes in Hawaii on the plantations were in fact Japanese women. Some coercively or voluntarily forced into prostitution for financial reasons.
You mentioned that the communities were sort of encapsulated within the plantation system and they didn't really have much contact with the outside until World War II. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about World War II and internment. I know it's kind of moving a little bit away from the picture, Bryce, but I think just for historical context and kind of to wrap up what we're talking about today, that might help.
Prior to the war, 1920s, 1930s, the plantations were really flourishing at this particular time in Hawaii. We also see, though, during the 1930s, a growing awareness of the imminent threat that the Japanese would, in fact, impose upon the consciousness of the American military officials. So American military officials were concerned with two primary issues. Number one, the growing expansion and conquests of the Japanese Empire beginning in the 1920s, 1930s to the various parts of the Pacific region. They were also concerned, though, of the growing numbers of the Japanese population in Hawaii, in the islands, prior to World War II, in very close proximity to the major naval, American naval facility in the Pacific, which was Pearl Harbor. So on the minds of military officials was the growing threat of the Japanese Empire and the growing number of Japanese who had established families and were having children and growing in numbers. And in fact, prior to World War II, the Japanese in Hawaii would constitute nearly 40% of the population. So that concerned military officials. So this is where there's actually a very nice transition. And we can, in fact, credit the Pitcher Prize because they, in fact, did have families and did have children and did create a growing population of Japanese individuals in Hawaii who were now, though, American citizens. But that did not factor in, for the most part, to the awareness of American military officials. So as Japan is expanding and Japan is encroaching upon various territories, the American military would enact an embargo, an oil embargo upon Japan to stop its territorial expansion. You know anything about the Japanese islands and Japanese resources? You know that Japan is an island nation. It is a resource-poor nation. So if you implement an oil embargo upon Japan, basically you are cutting off Japan from her lifeblood, from her colonies, from her supplies. So the Pearl Harbor attack, from the Japanese perspective, was an incident that was provoked by the Americans. From the American perspective, it was a dastardly, cowardly attack that will take place on December 7th, 1941, which was a Sunday morning in beautiful Hawaii. So even prior, though, to the attack itself, American military officials, civil officials, the FBI, the Office of Naval Intelligence had investigated the local Japanese population here in the islands, fearing an insurrection would occur in the event of a Japanese attack or invasion. So even prior to the Pearl Harbor attack, they had a pickup list of suspected individuals who they believed would pose an imminent threat to American security, and they were to be arrested in the event of the Japanese attack. So when Japanese, in fact, did attack on December 7th, 1941, immediately right after the attack, Honolulu Police Department, the FBI, military officials would literally go around the various islands of Oahu, visit the various plantations, urban centers, and pick up prominent individuals of the Japanese community, such as Japanese language teachers, business leaders, newspaper editors, sometimes even fishermen, consular officials, or consular representatives, and they would round them up and take them to various incarceration sites throughout the various islands. So we know there's at least 11 of them spread across the islands. These individuals were treated like prisoners who had committed a crime, despite the fact that there was no actual proof. They would be arrested, fingerprinted, sometimes strip searched, interrogated, and they would spend often the duration of war in these various concentration camps, as we often refer to them as internment centers across the islands before they would eventually be shipped off to the mainland incarceration centers. So literally overnight, people would disappear. And that inspired great fear within the Japanese population. So unlike mainland incarceration, where over 120,000 Japanese Americans, entire communities and families would be removed, it simply was just not feasible. It was not possible here in the islands. Where are we going to move them to? They constitute the majority of the population. We need them for labor purposes, not just on the plantations, but also to help rebuild Pearl Harbor. So instead, we're going to have this strategy of instilling fear in the rest of the remaining population who would be concerned about facing that particular threat. So during the war, while 120,000 Japanese Americans on the mainland were incarcerated, here in Hawaii, we also had about 1,200 that also would be arrested. And that's something a lot of people don't know, but America does do racial profiling. It does arrest people on the sole basis of race. And because there was martial law, there was military government, military rule, military courts, civil rights and constitutional rights could be set aside for the duration of the war. So that how it was in fact made possible.
That's so crazy to think about. I mean, obviously you think about internment in World War II and you do see these pictures. I mean, most people I would think have seen pictures of it now, and you do see whole families together and whole communities. And I never really considered that the population in Hawaii would be different. It's just not feasible to incarcerate that number of people. But it's also interesting that the government or the military is so fearful of Japanese, but still needs them. And they're the ones rebuilding Pearl Harbor and still working. And so it's an interesting perspective that I never really thought about.
Right. So, I mean, it was a perfect transition. As I said, oh no, picture brides relate to internment, relate to the threat of the Japanese, because they would establish, I mean, some marriages did work out. Many people had children. And so when we're talking about not just a sustaining, but growing population, the American military officials were concerned about two growing threats, literally. The Japanese population domestically and the Japanese abroad, the Japanese in Japan, who were expanding territorially throughout the Pacific. And they feared that, you know, because there were so many Japanese, that of course, would have an incredible alliance and allegiance to the Japanese emperor. And upon essentially, you know, an invasion, which is what they actually fear, or an attack, the Japanese here would rise up, especially after all of the resentments and discrimination they had faced on the plantations. So it did make sense. They would rise up and overthrow the American government. So it's kind of this weird causational relationship between the plantations and the military and their perceived threat, but they contributed to it at the same token. So, you know, this plantation history is in fact directly aligned with the events that would in fact transpire with internment or incarceration. You know, the plantations wanted picture brides to arrive to create a more secure and stable society, but yet they feared the fact that they were now having children and creating that stable society that they in fact wanted.
I was going to say something about the fact that they wanted more children, and I'm sure they wanted more workers and laborers for the field. But when these people were having children, now they would have been considered U.S. citizens, right? Right. So then if we could talk about citizenship a little bit, I know it wasn't later until like the 1950s when that law where Japanese were ineligible for citizenship based on race would be changed. But maybe you could talk a little bit about that. And was there any concern about birthright citizenship?
That is wonderful to kind of think about. I mean, when you're looking about this issue of citizenship, so we have two generations predominantly within the pre-World War II community. We have the first generation, the Issei, who would be denied citizenship up until 1952 with the McCarran-Walter Act. So they couldn't be citizens no matter what. So even if they claimed loyalty to America or renounced their Japanese citizenship, they would be a stateless individual. So people always say, well, one of the demonstrations that you could do is to show how loyal you are to America is renounce your home citizenship. Well, if you did that at that particular time, you would be a stateless citizen. You would not have any rights. You would not be aligned or have any legal protections. The second generation, the Nisei, would be a little bit more interesting because all of them were born with dual citizenship. And there was various processes in which you could maintain your dual citizenship or renounce your Japanese citizenship. But it was a process that you had to go through, at least initially, before it was in fact something that you had to also additionally pursue as an option. So, you know, again, here is America. It's very kind of contradictory that we are concerned about these unassimilable, these alien elements in society, but yet we are denying immigrants the opportunity to demonstrate their allegiance or citizenship by granting them this opportunity to become an American citizen. So, you know, we do have, you know, the military having this great fear of though not just the first generation, but also the second generation. Because think about how closely tied often second generation individuals are still to their home country. Especially if you have parents who are essentially citizens of their home country. So, you know, when you think about the Nisei generation, they're a very interesting generation in which that they were faced with often a difficult decision of how to demonstrate their loyalty, especially after experiencing discrimination and racism for much of their life. I mean, just that kind of contradiction. Interesting enough, many of them, in fact, would serve, answer the call for military service during World War II, joining very famed military regiments like the 100th Infantry Battalion and the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. All of this would kind of demonstrate, in part, the loyalty that many Japanese did, in fact, feel towards America.
Is there anything else you want to add?
I think it's wonderful that you folks are interested in Picture Brides. I encourage anyone. It's kind of this very romantic kind of understanding of immigration. I think it's something that people would not consider an avenue of immigration. I mean, or motivation for immigration, but that's something that still occurs even till today. I mean, we have TV shows, we have sitcoms of it. We have very profitable online dating sites in which people look at images and profiles of people and they fall in love. And, you know, just coming from a personal perspective, I mean, I do have two girlfriends who met their partners online.
So not much has changed. Not much has changed, I think. The whole story of Picture Brides, to me, when I first heard of it, was so interesting because coming from a steamship history perspective, one, just thinking about the women having to travel that length of time, not having seen anybody, weeks on end, as you mentioned, in some pretty desperate conditions. But I mean, the story sort of has everything. It has travel. It has immigration. It has race, labor, citizenship, all these larger questions that kind of just tell you so much about American history that I just found it a really fascinating topic. So thank you so much for sharing all your wisdom with us.
No, I mean, I hope people continue to, you know, research this. It's something that really is something that I think the stories of women have been underrepresented in history. And really kind of delving into the experiences, and in particular, people have insight about the experiences of Korean women who face multiple discriminations of not being Japanese and not being American and also being aliens within this country. They face multiple discriminations at this particular time. So I hope people research more about it. Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk with you. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning into Ship History Radio. We hope you enjoyed this two-part interview with Dr. Kelly Nakamura. This interview was conducted as part of our program SHIPS, which stands for Ships, History, Influence, and Power series. You can learn more at shiphistory.org/ships. To learn more about the Steamship Historical Society, visit sshsa.org.